The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session.
Judge Conley.
Judge Bjorkman. Judge Johnson. The Honorable Francis J. Conley presiding.
Thank you. Good morning. Sorry, we're starting a little late. We had some technical difficulties. Our first case this morning is 822-0024, State of Minnesota versus Perry Helms. As all parties are aware, the appellant will have 15 minutes for their argument in chief, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then finally the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please keep in mind, for anyone who is listening online, this is being recorded and will be available to listen to tomorrow, but private recordings are strictly prohibited. With that, counsel for the appellant, you may begin, sir.
Thank you, and may it please. My name is Benjamin Butler, represent the appellant Perry Helms. In a lot of ineffective assistance cases, the defendant complains that his attorney picked the wrong defense to use in the case. This is not one of those cases. Mr. Helms' attorney wanted to defend the case on grounds that the state couldn't prove that Mr. Helms acted with the specific intent to kill or with premeditation. And that defense was eminently reasonable under these facts. What was unreasonable was counsel's belief that voluntary intoxication was somehow different than the defense counsel planned to raise. In addition, counsel's performance was deficient because counsel misunderstood the requirements of voluntary intoxication. And because of that, Mr. Helms received prejudicially ineffective assistance of counsel, and he must be allowed to withdraw his guilty plea. Counsel's performance was deficient for basically three reasons. First, counsel didn't realize that voluntary intoxication goes hand in glove with the planned defense. At page 20 of the transcript, counsel seemed to differentiate between the two. At page 26, counsel said that he chose to defend the case on grounds of intent as opposed to on voluntary intoxication grounds. There is no difference between those two things. Voluntary intoxication allows the jury to consider the defendant's intoxication when deciding whether the state can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant acted with specific intent. And a reasonable attorney under these facts, knowing the defendant was intoxicated, would at least give pretrial notice of intent to rely on voluntary intoxication. That notice doesn't commit the defense to anything in particular, but without it, the defense attorney cannot later on even introduce evidence of the client's intoxication. And Mr. Kuchera, the defense attorney in this case, did not give that notice. Even though he knew that his client was intoxicated to some degree, and even though he planned to defend the case on the mental state grounds. Now, counsel said he never made a final decision on whether to pursue a voluntary intoxication defense. And he said that he was always constantly reevaluating his choices. But by not giving the notice pre-trial, counsel had, in fact, made a final decision, or at least committed himself and his client to the
Mr. Butler, assuming we agree with you that defense counsel got that wrong and should have made the notice and preserved that as a potential defense, what is it about this record that would compel us to conclude that the failure to do so prejudiced your client?
Sure. So good question, Your Honor. The standard, obviously, is whether had counsel performed correctly, there's a reasonable probability that the defendant would not have pleaded guilty. And that's all we have to show, that he wouldn't have pleaded guilty. And I think you can look to your decision in Montermini, which, although is unpublished, non-precedential, is a very thorough and highly persuasive opinion by Judge Schumacher, where Judge Schumacher explains that where the defendant is not told the proper information about a defense, something that would mitigate his culpability, or in that case, eliminate it altogether, which it would here too for the two top counts, that there is a reasonable probability that the defendant would not have pleaded guilty and would have gone to trial. And I think the other thing that's important in Montermini is that the trial judge and post-conviction judge in Montermini found, as a factual matter, that he didn't believe that the defendant would ever have pleaded guilty and would never have taken the case to trial. And this court nonetheless said no. This court nonetheless reversed and said the problem there is that it just begs the question that the judge is assuming that adequate information would not have been sufficient to have the defendant make a different choice. In addition, like in Montermini, Mr. Helms, because he was misinformed, he didn't have the opportunity to meaningfully waive the defense of voluntary intoxication because he wasn't given adequate information about it. I won't say he wasn't told about it. Mr. Kuchera said he used the phrase voluntary intoxication with his client. But of course, as Mr. Helms testified at that hearing, he's not a lawyer, and he was relying on the person with the law degree to tell him what were his defenses. There's no reason he would even know that his being intoxicated has anything to do with his
Mr. case. Butler, there were lots of credibility determinations made by the district court at the hearing. So do any of those relate to whether your client is believable when he said he would not have pled guilty?
Yeah, the district court basically discredited, I think fair to say, almost everything Mr. Helms testified to. I acknowledge that. The same thing is true in Montermini. In Montermini, the district court discredited the defense testimony, saying he wouldn't have pled guilty. And so what happens when you discredit testimony is that it basically goes away.
Montermini, as I understand it, had some other evidence presented, correct? I mean, from an expert, from both an attorney who said that mental illness defense should absolutely have been presented, and from a mental health expert. I mean, what evidence again was produced here that would compel us to find that, not, you know, setting aside the credibility findings, that just the circumstances of this case are such that the involuntary intoxication defense was so strong that, you know, that it compels letting him withdraw his guilty plea?
I think there's a couple of pieces of circumstantial evidence, Your Honor. First is that Mr. Helms has always maintained his innocence of the two top counts against him. All the way through his guilty plea, he entered an Alford plea to attempted intentional murder. So this is not a defendant who was desperate to plead guilty. This was not a defendant who came in and said, I did what I did and I'll take the consequence for it. This is a defendant who, even when he thought he had no defense because his lawyer had misadvised him, maintained his innocence all the way to the plea hearing. So this idea that had he known he had a real defense, there's no reasonable probability that he would have pleaded guilty, I don't think works under the facts of this case, given his maintenance of innocence. The other piece of circumstantial information is that Mr. Helms seemed to, on some intrinsic level, recognize the relevance of his intoxication. I mean, it's the first thing he told his lawyer at their first meeting, is that he had been drinking and using marijuana. It is a thing he brought up repeatedly during his meetings with his lawyer, how much he could remember about the offense, which I agree kind of came and went, but he certainly maintained that he was intoxicated. It is also a thing that has extrinsic support in the record. Obviously, we have the blood alcohol test, which shows a considerably high blood alcohol level. Now, maybe 1.127 is not super high on the level of chronic alcoholic criminal defendants, but it is pretty high on the level of a human being. Not only is that obviously well above the legal limit, and the information in our brief shows how science can tell you that a person at 127 is pretty darn drunk. And Mr. Helms was pretty darn drunk at the time of this incident, which at least cuts against the premeditation count for sure.
Mr. Butler, I'm sorry to interrupt. I'd like to go back to your argument that Mr. Kuchera's performance was deficient because he did not realize that intoxication and intent are essentially the same issue. I mean, he testified in the post-conviction hearing that the client, I think, wanted to contend that he was not guilty because he wanted only to scare her, not to kill her. Am I correct about that?
I'm not sure it was that specific, Your Honor, and I'll rest on whatever the transcript says. I think the only thing that we know is that the client said he didn't intend to kill her.
But isn't that different from I did something because I was drunk? In other words, I mean, if he wants to say, it sounds like the client wanted to assert the defense that what he did deliberately, intentionally, knowingly, and perhaps with a clear head, but he simply pulled the trigger intending to scare her, not to kill her. Isn't that different from inconsistent with the statement that, you know, I didn't really intend to do any of that. I was just drunk and therefore I didn't have the specific intent to even pull the trigger.
Yeah, again, Your Honor, I don't want to say anything contrary to what's in the transcript. I do not recall the testimony being that specific as to how Mr. Helms wanted to defend the case. There may have been testimony about I was just trying to scare her, but it's also not on Mr. Helms to craft the defense. It's on the defense lawyer. I would also say that any idea that Mr. Helms was acknowledging that he was acting intentionally and with a clear head is contrary to the record. What Mr. Helms told his lawyer repeatedly is that he was drunk, that he was high, and that he most of the time would say he didn't remember. He didn't even remember most of the incident. Sometimes he said he didn't remember it at all. Sometimes he said he remembered only bits and pieces of it. Whether the lawyer believed him or not is almost irrelevant.
The district court made a statement that the lawyer was mistaken. What was that mistake, according to the district court?
The way I read the district court's order, Your Honor, is that the mistake was in the lawyer's understanding of what voluntary intoxication required. The lawyer testified very clearly that he thought voluntary intoxication meant that he had to prove that Mr. Helms was not capable of forming the requisite level of intent, that he was so intoxicated that his brain essentially didn't work and that it was like a McNaughton defense. That's my word, not the lawyer's McNaughton, but that's the equivalent of what the lawyer testified to. That is 100% not true. The only thing that voluntary intoxication requires is intoxication to some degree. And all the Supreme Court cases, criminal jig and the statute on intoxication make that clear. So when the lawyer says, I'm rejecting voluntary intoxication because I don't think you're drunk enough, or I don't think you look drunk enough in this squad video, which is what he said, the mistake and the deficient performance there is that he's doing it under the wrong standard, because he's holding Mr. Helms to a standard that the law does not hold Mr. Helms.
Well, is that clear? I mean, I think that Mr. Kuchera made an assessment of the evidence and the likelihood that the jury would be persuaded by the evidence of intoxication and would be the likelihood that the jury would return a not guilty verdict with that defense. But it's not clear to me that the lawyer's assessment was based on the burden of proof rather than simply, you know, the value of the evidence. And I don't think the lawyer ever said that he made that recommendation to the client because of the burden of proof. Am I correct about that?
Well, no, I'm not sure, Your Honor, because the lawyer was asked very clearly, what do you know about intoxication? And what he said is, if the person is sufficiently intoxicated as to not be able to form the requisite intent, it can be used as a defense. I believe the defendant has the burden of kind of establishing intoxication. And
that much is true, right?
True, that phrase.
Okay.
And then he goes on to say, and that it was sufficiently high that they were unable to form the requisite intent. That's page 42.
Right. So then you caught him in a perhaps a situation of not knowing the law perfectly, but did that mistake in the understanding of the law infect the advice, or that the ultimate recommendation and the advice that was given to the client, which is that there are other defenses that are better than the voluntary intoxication defense?
It did, Your Honor, because when the lawyer tells the client you weren't drunk enough, that's the standard under which he's judging how drunk the client was. If he thinks the law requires the client to be so drunk that he can't show, that he can't establish, I'm sorry, that he was unable to form the requisite intent, which is what he thinks, when he tells the client, you weren't drunk enough for us to invoke voluntary intoxication, that's the mistake. I would also say that this...
So he should have just said, what? Any intoxication is enough?
What he should have...
I mean, Unfortunately, many people who commit crimes are intoxicated. So it's got to be, looking at the jig, you know, if you find the defendant was intoxicated, okay, so he was, you may take that fact into consideration in determining whether or not the defendant acted with the required intent or state of mind. I mean, I think that kind of bolsters right. Judge Johnson's question. It's, you know, it's, I mean, I don't know, maybe the right word is not drunk enough, but, you know, you've got to be intoxicated so that it affects and to prove to the jury that you didn't have the required intent or state of mind. And I thought that was what the lawyer was trying to get at. It's kind of like, you know, we can go in front of the jury with this, but at the end of the day, you know, you pulled a gun to your significant other's head while she's holding a children. I don't know. That's where I was thinking it. Now, maybe I'm wrong. If you want to respond to that, Mr. Butler, you can, rather than taking that out of your rebuttal.
I appreciate that, Your Honor. I would like to respond, and I'll be brief. I think you need to read that last sentence of the jig really carefully. All it says is that the jury can take it into account. That's it. The fact of intoxication. That's it. That's all that instructions allows the jury to do.
Right, and I'm saying, you know, I bet they wouldn't have. I mean, what I thought the lawyer was saying was, you know, they're probably not going to take it into account very much because of the facts.
Your Honor, that's not what the lawyer said.
Okay.
I mean, the problem with when we have an evidentiary hearing and we know exactly why the lawyer did what he did, that might be what some lawyer would think looking at this case, but it's not what Mr. Kuchera thought. And it's not the advice Mr. Kuchera gave his client or the reason he gave his client. The only other thing I want to note is that you did mention the burden. The burden is only to prove intoxication. The defense's burden is only to prove that the defendant was intoxicated. And it seems to be undisputed here that the defendant was intoxicated, at least to some degree.
Thank you. We'll now hear for counsel for the appellant. And before we start, I certainly do wish to, Mr. Smith, express the condolences of the panel and the court on the death of Mr. Sanow. That's very, very tragic. He was a very fine lawyer. I was asked also, unfortunately we have records, is there currently an acting county attorney that we should update and replace Mr. Sanow with?
First of all, Judge Connolly, thank you on behalf of my colleagues at the Nobles County Attorney's Office for your expression of sympathies. There is actually not only an acting county attorney, there is now an appointed county attorney. Braden M. Hofer is the appointed county attorney as of Tuesday.
And could you, thank you, would you just ask, I hope I pronounced it correctly, Mr. Hofer, to just file a letter just saying that? Because, you know, that's what we require. But thank you very much for telling me that. Thank you.
Certainly, Your Honor.
You may continue, Mr. Smith, with your argument.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Travis Smith, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota in this appeal. Rather than go into any sort of canned remarks at this point in time, I want to jump right into this issue and first answer Judge Johnson's question about the record, specifically page 52 of the transcript. Mr. Butler's absolutely right. We know exactly why the attorney did what he did here. And here are his very own words. Generally overall, I felt that the best defense was that he did not have the intent to kill. Not only that he didn't have the intent to kill, he had specifically intended not to kill her. He just wanted to scare, pardon my French, the hell out of her. That was the best defense and the one I gave the most credence to. That's exactly why Mr. Kuchera did what he did here. His minor foibles about exactly what the law requires, as I've asserted in my brief, I think that there's Supreme Court decisions that support precisely Mr. Kuchera's analysis of what the defense ultimately requires. But more to Judge Johnson's point, Mr. Kuchera assessed that raising the voluntary intoxication defense on these weak facts for that defense would directly contradict the defense he thought was the best defense. And that's his decision to make, is which defense is the best defense to assert. And that's that the defendant had formed a specific intent not to kill the victim, but to scare her. that it was a, is it was an argument.
But isn't it the defendant's choice? I mean, wasn't Mr. Helms entitled to be appropriately advised of the legal requirements for each of those defenses and weigh in on the decision? Isn't that the problem here, that that he didn't get an accurate assessment of to make the choice himself, whether to understand the defenses he was giving up and their strength?
I disagree with I agree that he should be adequately advised about the availability of defenses. And his attorney should advise him about their strengths. But I think the law is clear that the ultimate choice about which defenses to assert is counsel's choice. That's a trial strategy choice. Now, to that point, Mr. Kachira testified that had the defendant insisted on asserting a voluntary intoxication defense, he would have done so. And I think that's important to take into consideration here. I think what we're trying, what's happening here is the decision of the advice about the intoxication defense and its decision are taken out of the broader context of the conversation that counsel's having with his client about the case and about how to proceed on the case. It seems pretty clear that along the way, the defendant pretty readily was willing to accept the initial plea proposal. In fact, it was Mr. Kachira who suggested they could do better and in fact made a counterproposal. I think what's happening here is we're Monday morning quarterbacking defense counsel strategy. It's important to again, I don't concede that his advice was incorrect. I think that the post-conviction court is not clear at all as to what it thinks the mistake was about the defense. First of all, Mr. Kachira advised that it was an available defense, and he never advised the defendant that he couldn't raise the defense based on the facts here. Instead, his testimony is consistent that he that it was his opinion, and he gave the advice that it wasn't the best defense. And that seems
he didn't even notice it as a defense, right? I mean,
he didn't notice it, to the extent that but that's not what was asserted as the ineffective assistance of counsel all the way through this proceeding up until this point in time, the failure to give a notice.
Well, but doesn't that go to the question of him not understanding the defense and how it would operate under these circumstances? And isn't that the alleged ineffectiveness, or at least part of it?
No, the alleged ineffectiveness has been a failure to adequately investigate the defense. That's the argument that's been made in the briefs. That was the argument, although it somewhat shifted from what was made in the post-conviction court. And I think this shift to the failure to give notice is more shifting sand. I think what we're seeing is that the sand is falling away under the appellant, and he's constantly changing the argument to try and gain a foothold. But the record doesn't support a foothold. Mr. Kachira recognized that the defense was a potential defense. He talked with his client about that. And he made a professional judgment based on the entirety of the circumstances here on what defense was the best to pursue. And contrary to counsel's assertion, the voluntary intoxication defense would be directly contrary to an argument that the defendant had a specific intent simply to scare the victim. Because if you're so intoxicated that you can't form the specific intent necessary for the charged offenses, it logically follows, even if it doesn't legally follow, it logically follows that you're so intoxicated that you couldn't form that specific intent either. So they are logically incompatible, even if they're not legally incompatible. And that's an important consideration that a trial attorney has to make in a practical determination. So I think that's important here. And again, appellant brushes off the Supreme Court's approval of an instruction in Wahlberg as an isolated case 43 years ago in one line. But the fact of the matter is the Supreme Court approved that instruction, which says that the intoxication defense has to make it such that the defendant couldn't form the requisite intent necessary for the crime. And that's really the only way it can be relevant. The defendant doesn't have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he couldn't form the requisite intent, obviously, but that's how it's relevant, is when it demonstrates that the defendant couldn't form the requisite intent to commit the crime. And so I maintain that trial counsel understood the parameters of the defense. he was aware of how it operated. The fact that he didn't give notice, quite frankly, the practical experience is that notice of defenses are routinely given after the omnibus hearing, and they're allowed to be presented as long as there's adequate notice to the state. That's I know what the rules say, and I wish the rules were they're more honored in their breach than in their observance, quite frankly.
I would certainly agree with that, Mr. Smith. In Hennepin County, it would usually use the day of trial was the notice that was given. I was wondering if we could shift to the bottom of the box argument, if please.
So certainly, Judge Connolly, quite frankly, there is no credible evidence in the record that the appellant misunderstood what his sentence was, that he thought he was getting a bottom of the box sentence. What's clear is that the state made an offer and he testified, the appellant testified in a not credible fashion at the post-conviction evidentiary hearing about what he thought that offer was. Instead, the state made an offer of 153 months. That was the initial offer. And he was willing to accept that offer. And the credible testimony is that Mr. Kuchera said, I think we can do better. I'm going to ask for the bottom of the box. And he asked the prosecutor for the bottom of the box. And the prosecutor rejected that argument. There were later conversations about how to proceed. And ultimately, the appellant elected to go for the certain sentence, the agreed upon sentence, which was the middle of the box. It was 153 months, which was the initial offer as a sure thing. He was given the opportunity to argue for a lower sentence, to argue for a bottom of the box sentence. But Mr. Kuchera testified at the post-conviction hearing, and the post-conviction court concluded that testimony was credible, that the appellant wanted to go for the sure thing rather than have the opportunity to obtain a bottom of the box sentence by arguing to the district court. That's the long and the short of it. There is no evidence that he didn't, no credible evidence that he didn't understand what sentence he was getting, that there were potential lower sentences. And in that regard, there simply is no evidence that counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, or that the outcome would have been different had he received a precise statement that you aren't receiving the bottom of the box sentence, and that the bottom of the box sentence is X number of months. Appellant seems to be claiming now that because he wasn't explicitly told the bottom of the box sentence for this offense based on your criminal history score is X, but that was ineffective assistance of counsel. But that's not what the law requires. The law requires that he understand the consequence of his plea. And he understood that he was getting a 153-month sentence and giving up an opportunity to argue for a lower sentence that still fell within the guidelines. And I think for that reason, the post-conviction court was absolutely correct on that count. And there is no basis for the defendant to withdraw his plea on that grounds. I want to briefly touch on appellant's reliance on Hart, and he doubles down pretty hard on this in his reply brief. And his reliance on Hart and this court's decision there to support his claim that his assertion that the drinking affected his memory is enough to assert that he assert intoxication as an explanation for his defense is misplaced, and it's misplaced for four reasons. First, the defendant in Hart testified not only that he did not testified that he did not remember anything from the previous night. Here, the defendant had some memory and was able to recount the details to Kuchera. In fact, that the district court, the post-conviction court, seriously called into question the credibility of defendant's testimony about his lack of memory later on. It was only after Mr. Kuchera told the appellant that he would have to lay a factual basis that he started to talk about a lack of memory. And in any event, he was able to recount the details. So there's that factual distinction from Hart. Second, the defendant in Hart notably testified that though he didn't remember what had happened and attributed that to his drinking, he thought he had done something wrong. And that's the important connection that makes the assertion between his drinking and the offense, that's what makes the assertion of an explanation. We don't have that here. We don't have the defendant, the appellant, telling his attorney that, well, I wouldn't have done that had I not been drinking, or I thought I did something wrong because I was drinking. None of that. Third, I think it's important to note that this court concluded that the failure to give the instruction in Hart was not reversible error. And I think that's noteworthy because we're here on ineffective assistance of counsel. And ineffective assistance of counsel has a higher standard than ordinary trial error for reversing. So if the failure to give the instruction in Hart, where the actual explanation was offered by the defendant, was not reversible error, the error here wasn't prejudicial. Fourth, and I've touched on this again, appellant's claims about his intoxication and lack of memory simply are not credible, and the post-conviction court concluded as much. See the post-conviction court's order at page 3. And he's failed to establish his burden of proof on the facts necessary to make out a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. Unless the court has other questions, I would simply ask this court to affirm.
Thank you. Seeing none, we'll move on to Mr. Butler, your rebuttal, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. I wanted to start with Judge Johnson's question and counsel's comments about a defense of specific intent to scare. That couldn't have been the defense because that is a concession of guilt to count 4 of the complaint, which is second degree assault with a dangerous weapon. If counsel's plan was to concede that Mr. Helms acted with the specific intent to scare the complainant, then counsel had to tell his client that, and his client had to affirmatively agree to concede guilt on count 4. That did not happen here. Nothing like that happened here. So this idea that the plan, the best plan, was what's essentially a concession of guilt is not true. And what counsel did, what the record in its entirety shows that counsel did, was that counsel discounted the degree to which the client was intoxicated. And again, I don't see any dispute. I think the state concedes in its brief that Mr. Helms was intoxicated. The lawyer discounted the extent to which that mattered because the lawyer doesn't understand how much intoxication is necessary to assert the defense, which is just simply intoxication. The lawyer also doesn't understand that all noticing the defense would do, and I'm going to get to Judge Bjorkman's concern about notice, all noticing the defense would do would be to allow the defense to present evidence of that intoxication and then allow the jury to consider that when deciding whether counsel's planned defense, the defense counsel was going to raise, had merit or not. To Judge Bjorkman's question about the lack of notice has always been a part of this case. It has always been a part of the ineffective assistance claim. If you look at document 111 at page 4, which is the post-hearing memorandum to the post-conviction court, you'll see that one of the claims is that one of the bases on which counsel's performance was deficient is that counsel failed to give notice that he intended to rely on evidence of the defendant's intoxication. Mr. Smith's claim that this is somehow shifting sands is 100% not true. Has always been part of this case. And the reason it's been part of the case, and the reason it came up is because Mr. Kuchera at the hearing testified that he actually, he backed off this idea that he had rejected voluntary intoxication. He said that he hadn't actually made a final decision on it, and that he would have done it, this thing about he would have done it if the client told him to, which again, I agree with Mr. Smith, other than concessions, it's Mr. Kuchera's decision, not the client's decision on what defenses to raise. So this idea that he puts it on his non-lawyer client to tell him what defenses to raise is a classic deficient performance. Mr. Helms only knows what Mr. Kuchera has told him. And what Mr. Kuchera has told him is voluntary intoxication isn't good, isn't a good defense. We shouldn't do it. So why would Mr. Helms then say to the person with the law degree, oh, I think you're wrong. I think we should talk about that. That doesn't make any sense.
Mr. Butler, I'd like to ask a question about the law about prejudice and what must be proved. You earlier said that your burden is to prove that but for the deficient performance, your client would not have pleaded guilty, but would have insisted on going to trial. Mr. Smith, in his response to brief, argues that you must prove more. You must also prove that at trial you would have been successful either in getting a not guilty verdict or in getting a shorter sentence. And he cites to the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Lee. You did not address that argument in your rebuttal, but I'm wondering if you could address it orally.
Certainly, Your Honor. The language Mr. Smith points to from Lee is dicta. That is not the issue in Lee. The issue in the holding of Lee is that all the defendant had to do was show that he wouldn't have pled guilty, and he made that showing, and therefore Mr. Lee wins. I don't know of any case from the United States Supreme Court or from the Minnesota Supreme Court or a published authority from this court holding that the defendant in an ineffective assistance guilty plea case has to show anything other than that he would not have pled guilty.
So I'm looking at Hill v. Lockhart, which mm-hmm. says that it says would have not pleaded guilty, would have insisted on going to trial. And then it continues by talking about how the analysis may include the likelihood, the prediction on whether the evidence likely would have changed the outcome of a trial. Similarly, might depend on whether an affirmative defense likely would have succeeded at trial. And then the Hill court cites Seventh Circuit's opinion in Evans, which is about an intoxication defense. It seems like Hill v. Lockhart itself requires more than just proof that the plea would have been rejected and the defendant would have gone to trial.
I see I'm out of time, Judge Connolly.
Go right ahead, Mr. Butler. Please answer the question. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. I'm not sure that's the holding of Hill, Your Honor. And even if it is, I think the way you read some of those cases is to say, look, if the defense is so meritless that there's no possibility that any jury would ever have bought it, then that relates back to the likelihood that the defendant would have pled guilty or gone to trial. Okay, so if the defense is, well, you didn't tell me that I could say aliens had come down from outer space and committed this crime, maybe that, let's say that's deficient performance for some reason, but no jury would ever buy that, so there's no reasonable probability you wouldn't have pleaded guilty. But here, you don't have to show, it doesn't make any sense to say we would have to prove success or a likelihood of success on the merits. That would require at a post-conviction hearing to meet our burden to try the case. Because that's the only way we could show to meet our burden, the only way we could show likelihood of success on the merits would be to call a bunch of witnesses and see and try the factual defense. That's not what the law requires. What the law requires is there some merit to the defense? Well, there's at least some merit to this defense. Whether a jury would have ultimately agreed or not is why we have juries. But there's at least some merit to this defense. And when the defendant is told the opposite, when he's told for the wrong reasons that there's no merit to the defense, and he basically has no shot, and he may as well take this plea, that's prejudicially deficient performance. And that's what happened here.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. Thank you, Mr. Smith. We will be issuing our decision within 90 days.
Thank you, Your Honors.
You're welcome.
Thank you.